All right, everybody, welcome back to the Takedown. And I am very excited to have my guest on today. And we were chatting before we were recording, and I was telling her that, you know, she's probably the person that I follow most closely in regards to what we'll be talking about today, especially what's going on in the world. Her name is Megan Mansell, and I'll let her tell you all about herself. And we have a lot of things to talk about today. I'm very excited. Megan, thank you for being here. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm sorry. My son wants his Carnotaurus.
That's okay.
Pardon the background noises. My background is as a district education director for special populations, which are severely and profoundly disabled, immunocompromised, autistic, the full integration of students who don't really, you know, fit the standard under full ADA, IDEA, and OSHA compliance with a background in containment PPE, which is the applications of which masks work when and why, and other PPE applications to keep yourself safe in exposure scenario. Awesome. So it's kind of more of where the rubber meets the road than what a lot of people's interaction with PPE or public sector application is. It's, you know, what can you ask of your employees? What can you ask of students and parents within a district and the employees who serve them, as well as what their general rights are for functioning within the public sector? So, yeah. You take a square peg that doesn't fit in a round hole and you whittle the hole instead of the square peg, and that's a public accommodation. And so that's really my wheelhouse.
Thank you very much. Well, you know, I think obviously there's a few questions that I have, and look, I'll be honest with you. I am a consumer like everybody else. Obviously I don't know a lot about this. I'm learning more about this. That's why I go to people like you. And I think considering myself to be, you know, I'm a husband, I'm a dad. I am a healthcare provider. I'm an employer. And people have a lot of concerns. And again, before we started recording, we talked a little bit about this. I guess a lot of the questions that some people have, they want to know about PPE and what works and what doesn't work, you know, in a population level, what are we doing here? So I guess specifically, first thing is, I guess, in your words, obviously you're smarter than I am, especially when it comes to this stuff. I guess maybe talking about particle physics, misapplications regarding the PPE, and I guess we can go from there.
Okay. So you were talking about, like, you represent your employees within the workplace. And if you are an employer with more than 15 employees, you're required to fall under certain federal guidelines for ADA integration. But all of your employees should be met with appropriate standards under OSHA. So if they have a noxious chemical or a noxious substance they're working with, or they're being exposed to a given pathogen, you look first at minimum viable particle size under pressure. And, you know, for a pathogen, that's where viability comes in. And so anything breaking it up further under that level is not considered viable. So the minimum viable particle size for COVID is 0.06 microns. That's very, very, very small. When you're looking at corresponding PPE, you would then look at, okay, what are my workplace requirements? What do I have to provide my employees with that is new, fit tested, has had both medical clearance and medical consent as part of the conversation? What do I need to provide them with in order to, you know, provide different levels of personal protection? And so with COVID size particulates, that's a baseline minimum of N95 or higher grade respirators plus eye protection, because everybody always forgets that your eyes are connected to the rest of your face. And when you're, you know, in an exposure scenario, if you are, you know, someone who considers yourself a vulnerable individual or at an increased risk of this, it's really important that we look at both inhalation standards, mm-hmm. and if you are transmissible with a given pathogen, well, what does that look like when you're exhaling it? Because COVID is so small, that it falls within the radically behaving particulate range. It's under 0.3 microns, which means it doesn't fall in that neat, predictable 6-foot arc that 6 feet over or 6 feet under rhetoric is dead.
Right.
COVID is 90% of your respiratory emissions fall within the under 0.3 micron range. So at the beginning, when everyone was shouting like droplet, 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 that really only accounts for about 10% of your respiratory emissions in a, you know, and then you get into, okay, well, there are fluctuations in respiratory emissions like plosive force generating events, coughs, sneezes, screams. These are all important to consider when you're calling something source control. And so what really matters is if you're contagious with a pathogen of this size and you're in a fitted mask, you then get into these plumes where it's creating these concentrated streams of fine particulate. And if there's enough pressure behind a non-vented mask, there's aerosolization of droplet through a membrane, which is taking what falls in that predictable 6-foot arc and sending it instead airborne into an 18 to 20 foot trajectory where it remains aloft for hours, even days. And, you know, then it's responding to the whim of airflow patterns. And general respiration is an airflow pattern. Mm-hmm. We should be telling people, you know, if you are a vulnerable individual, you should not be in a contained space with a transmissible positive, especially if they're in one of these masks, because each exhale has enough viral matter to infect, you know, if you were in a small contained space with a large number of people, each exhale that a transmissible positive emits into that given space is increasing that atmospheric viral load. And this is a minimal infective dose, minimal infective dose pathogen. This is a very low viral load pathogen for transmission. And what matters there is, what's your overall health? What are you doing to improve your health over time and increasing your chances of being able to ward off a respiratory pathogen? Are you immunosuppressing yourself? Are you engaging in depressive behaviors or health-seeking behaviors? All of these things will have an impact on what your personal minimum infective dose is. Because it's all about, well, are you able to fight it off locally? Or does it require you to develop antibodies to be able to fight it off? Your individual health status matters a great deal. And that's something that you can be personally responsible for changing over time for many people. So then looking at the respirators themselves and the fit of different respirators will be able to tell you, okay, you have to look at everything specifically and just be incredibly specific with your information that you're giving the public. You need to be hearing. Cloth masks have no production standards, so no two are alike. You can't tell me that there's any given percentage efficacy of something that is completely unstandardized.
Right.
It's made with old cloth that it has varying pore sizes and varying matrix structures that has been sitting around dusty on a shelf for a long time, that was handmade, that's going through your washing machine. That's, you know, a lot of people live in apartment complexes and use laundry facilities. These places aren't sterile. You're not in you're mixing it in with every single other thing that people are washing theirs with as well. And so just looking at each of the different grades of PPE themselves and saying, okay, what does this have any value at all with the pathogen at hand. Surgical masks are expressly and by design for catching droplet and splatter in close proximity settings like dental practices in combination with eye protection. And they came into popularity during the AIDS crisis to prevent bloodborne transmission through oral and nasal mucosa, as well as ocular mucosa. So getting into the details of this and seeing, if you actually look at what exhale looks like on with somebody wearing a surgical mask, it just plumes out the side. And then you have more of a concentrated stream than just the general downward trajectory. And you have to look at the changes in respiration when people are breathing in a mask versus when you're breathing regularly. Regularly, you breathe through your nose a lot. It's generally pretty shallow. And have you ever just had a conversation with somebody and they just kept sucking that mask back into their mouth and there's no pop each time? You're pulling each, you know, what's on the inside of that mask deeper into the lungs each time. And people really struggle for breath when they're wearing things. And we've had this just one size fits all, you know, do this, do gutter approach. That has really put people's lives at risk by not being specific enough here. And you know, I could go on for days.
So. No, this is great. And I just think that, and I'm thinking as you're talking here, you know, a couple of things that come to my mind is for example, yesterday I walked down. So where my clinic is, a few doors down, there's a Dunkin' Donuts. Mm-hmm. And I'm on my little app, you know, I ordered my coffee and I walk, you know, 50 yards down the road there, down the sidewalk. I walk and I pick up my coffee and I leave. And by the way, regarding what you're talking about, surgical masks. So if we do a sterile procedure in my clinic, we take all the necessary, because we're doing injections, we're doing things like mm-hmm. that. And, you know, we take all the necessary safety. We do all that. But like you're saying with the splatter. But anyway, when I went down to Dunkin' Donuts, I was waiting when I walked in, my order wasn't quite ready yet. So I'm just sitting in there and I noticed a guy behind me walking out. There's a million people in there. And I noticed a guy walking in the door. He had a shirt, just pulled his shirt up over his nose to walk in and just stood in line. And I'm thinking to myself, I happen to be the only one in there without wearing a mask. And I felt like I was the only one that was doing it right. You know what I mean? People have their shirts pulled over their nose. They have these things. I see people with their masks hanging over their rear view mirrors. People were going into, that's something else too, that I saw that you had mentioned on Twitter about going into a public restroom and, you know, on a population level.
Really gross stuff to have to get into. I never thought that I would be discussing these things publicly.
It's nuts. It really is. And I think, like I said, I learned these things and I think about it. I'm like, on a population level, you know, and again, we can get into the kids too. I would love to talk about that as well. But I mean, people were walking around with gaiters on and they're pulling their shirts up over their nose and nobody even no and nobody says anything. So in a little bit of my, this is just my opinion, I'll leave the science to you with this, but my opinion is people are doing these things just to appease other people, it seems like.
Absolutely.
To me, they know that doesn't work.
You've had a year by now to do a simple Google search on what it actually takes to be protected against a pathogen of this size. And I will take you seriously and stay away from you if you look like you're going to the moon.
Right.
Absolutely, hands down. And what this is scary to me is, like, so much of what my experience is the actual planning of truly immunocompromised people and how, like, what is best practice for them to be able to be a part of the regular mainstream with access points, like to whatever degree possible that is. And I want to give people who are truly immunocompromised kind of back a lease on life, but this isn't it. This is telling people, you know, this is a Band-Aid on a bullet hole. And for truly immunocompromised people, I think you do see some people who are like, well, I can kind of finally feel comfortable not feeling like a freak going out in public in an apparatus, because the public was very unwelcoming to the truly immunocompromised pre-COVID. There's nothing wrong in the world with suddenly having clean shopping cart handles or clean door handles. Like, right. There are public sanitation things that it's like, okay, yeah, we needed this. Glad we addressed this. And hey, you know, people who are truly vulnerable, let's let them have separate access to shared spaces and early hours to allow for overnight airflow and, you know, smaller concentrations of people within a given space. But telling people to go and commingle in the same space just with this apparatus that doesn't actually protect them is really, really dangerous practice for people. And especially speaking about children, there are a vast multitude of exemptions for school systems and for workplaces for people, and people don't know how to assert themselves. But the real kicker is there are zero efficacy standards for child-sized masks. Every single mask you would see on a child is completely unregulated. Where are the school system consent forms of medical clearance and consent like you'd be required to have in your workplace? We don't have that for children. Well, we know that linguistic onset requires being able to see tooth, tongue, and lip placement within the mouth. And we develop as you know, small children through emulating social cues of our caregivers' faces. And so, you know, you're masking the babies, you're masking their caregivers, and you're going to see a huge uptick in what people are going to refer to as spectrum diagnoses disorders, you know, of the autism spectrum, because so much of that relies on parental reporting. So much of it is just documenting observation and, you know, missing developmental milestones for language and social cues mimics what you see in profoundly autistic children. And it's going to be really hard to tell the difference between the two. It's just absolutely tragic. And also with school systems, it's a least restrictive educational environment issue. Under the federal IDEA guidelines 300.114 through 300.120 of IDEA, I really recommend people read up on those sections, because it outlines, you know, what your rights are for a vast multitude of those qualifying disabilities. ADA, you have right to reasonable accommodation within the public sector, wherein mere presence does not constitute direct threat, even if transmissibly contagious. You know, that's why your patients are able to, you know, I'm sure you've faxed plenty of prescriptions into places like Target, where the pharmacy is within the store. Why were you able to fax in flu meds for a transmissible pathogen pre-COVID if we didn't have public sector access rights when we're sick? We've just decided all of a sudden to start ignoring federal law, and that's really dangerous territory. So
yeah, and I think honestly, more than anything, that's what gets me. And you know, I've been vocal on social media about you know, my recent things I have going on with the local school and this medical board that's new. It's a private school, but the medical board is new within the last like year and a half, and they really kind of, I guess, gotten together most recently in the past year-ish. But I had a meeting yesterday, and I was telling you this, and the person I was talking to, and just to kind of give you the gist, basically parents are fed up. Parents are fed up, faculty is fed up, and kids, and more so it's the 7th through 12th grade that's having the biggest effect that parents are seeing. And I sat down, I chatted with this lady yesterday, and her frustration is the same as mine. I have a lot. Was what you're saying is people are ignoring law. And even when you present the data, it's almost like these people, and this is just my opinion, and I have another meeting on Tuesday, but my opinion is it seems like the head of the school is kind of, it's like they're waffling on, they trust what we say, but they don't want to make other people feel a certain way about it. You know what I mean? It's like, well, I don't want to, you know, it's like some churches, you know, my church talking to a pastor, they'll say, well, yeah, you know, I hear what you're saying, the masks don't work. And, you know, I want to, but I don't want to make a certain percent of the population mad at me. You know what I mean? So
it's a really easy bluff to call. All you have to do is ask people, do a survey for your school, all of your employees, all of your families. Do you now newly consider yourselves immunocompromised as a family grouping since the start of COVID? Or do you as an employee feel the need for greater protection? And so then you just staff out into tiered groupings for, you know, match the teachers with the students who feel the need for added protection, and then you stop trying to control the rest of the population. On a global basis, this has a 99.6% survivability rate, but that doesn't mean that we just ignore the other 0.4%, which equates to 31,200,000 people on a global basis. It's way easier to accommodate those people and provide meaningful measures of protection for them than it is to control the other 99.6% of the population. So we do that by first needing to know how who falls under which category. If you have a broken arm and you come to school and you need somebody to write for you, well, I'm never going to know that you need that accommodation until you represent yourself and say that you have this need. And so it's no different than that, both for employees and for students. You were talking about 7th to 12th graders. Okay, if you have a school auditorium, you can distance your teacher from the students and teach lecture style if it's just the employee who needs the distance and added protection, or that person could teach solely over Zoom while, you know, an aide watches the whole class. But, you know, punishing the entire school for having a handful of employees and families who need this added protection is really the backwards way to go about it, because people then become minimally compliant. Right. If you have a child with a peanut allergy, like I'm sure you've dealt a lot with that, in the school staffing, it works either two ways. Either you tell the entire school, okay, we are a legume-free facility, do not eat peanuts and do not send them to school. Somebody's great grandma packs lunch and somebody ends up stabbing an EpiPen into a kid's leg on the playground. Like, that's what happens when you try to force mass compliance, and right, it's not actually protective for the person. But if you say, okay, we have a third grader with a peanut allergy, is anybody, you know, willing to brush your teeth, wash your hands if you've had peanuts at home before coming to school, and not pack them for lunch, and like really try to take that seriously. When you have that buy-in ahead of time, and there's a specific person whose name is riding on, you know, needing this added protection, it becomes personal, and you get that buy-in when you give people a choice. These mandates are shown to have far higher case rates than non-mandating districts. And, you know, that's why it's important that we look at the behavior of a particle, you know, within a contained space and what the actual mitigation measures are for an airborne pathogen, because we never really pivoted away from this being called a droplet-based pathogen, even though it's really, really, really airborne with a little bit of droplet. And so then, you know, Google your town's name, test site, mask, COVID. And yes, just see what comes up. And you're going to see vented N95 respirators, where if you actually see what a vented N95 respirator plume looks like, and I'll just show that real quick because I just think it's an important visual. But if you actually see what a vented N95 plume looks like,
that's nuts.
And then you see, well, we have those exact same vented N95 plumes going right in your car window at a test site.
Right
over your testing materials. You know, that's a contamination of site environment. That's an invalidation issue with our testing materials. So you have insecure site materials, and you have PCR thresholds too high to indicate live viral matter, while also not doing any live dead confirmation for testing. Now, I could very easily from this solely argue, okay, asymptomatic and presymptomatic spread. Asymptomatic could completely be contaminated test materials with PCR thresholds too high for live viral matter. And presymptomatic spread could be that person breathing over this is your first point of contact, because a test site admin, especially with a novel pathogen, is the most likely person to be coming into contact with that novel pathogen. And then they're breathing it right in front of your car window over your testing materials. And some people haven't come into contact with other human beings in 9 months. And they're saying, well, how did I get this? Everybody was masking. Right. And, you know, it's just from not being specific enough. And it's really dangerous.
Well, you know, excuse me, what you said before, and I love that, what you said, and I wrote it down. You said, if you look like you're going to the moon, I'll take you seriously. So are we talking about PAPR, things like that?
That's personal protection. And if you're talking about like a fully integrated unit or, you know, my personal minimum, if I were in a contained space with somebody I knew was positive, that I was passing through very quickly of something I really didn't want to get, I would, you know, have fully goggled eyes and like a P100 on with, you know, reusable pocket respirator. I would go big if I was, you know, it's worth spending a little money and looking a little silly if this is something that if you feel like you already would be at risk with any other respiratory pathogen, you are probably doing a good job evaluating your own risk. And every year there are people who, you know, don't do a great job evaluating your own risk. But in California, last I checked, you can ride a tiger off a cliff through a hoop, smoking a joint without a parachute, as long as you're wearing a mask. And it's right. Like we have this stupid logic that this thing is going to be all protective and without ever having to look at the details and without actually having to allow people to take personal responsibility and say, you know, maybe I am at risk. And then we get to the conversations where we can say, well, what else can you do to decrease that risk? What are some measures in your life, or what are some environs control measures we could take? Because, you know, just telling people, okay, put this on, get back to it. Well, yeah, we're going to be digging graves, right, with that kind of attitude. Right. So,
well, you know, even, and that's important. I see a lot of people talking about that, mostly physicians and healthcare providers. I'll see them talking about that, you know, vitamin D levels being low, obesity, comorbidities, age, and that's all well and good. And, you know, and I tell people that all the time, and people obviously are starting to see more and more of that. And I think most recently an article came out that said, you know, physical exercise reduces chance of, you know, serious symptoms or being hospitalized. And I thought to myself, a lot of this just is common sense. And to me, you know, that applies with anything, you know, that applies with influenza A or B, you know, pneumonia. I mean, I've been around people in my life that have had a flu, influenza A, and I never had symptoms of it. You know, that is a thing. You know what I mean? It's like people thought that not until last year that life had risk, and all of a sudden nobody thinks it like that, you know, everybody has to live to be 120. Nobody can die anymore. And, you know, there's obviously that side to it too, with me about, you know, civil liberties, but we don't have to get into that. But I think that
we can get into civil liberties, because a caged bird doesn't sing. That's a big part of this. You know, you're being punished. You're being imprisoned in your own houses for crimes you never committed. I mean, house arrest is an actual punishment, and we've all experienced that. And you know, we're also not doing a very good job representing the people who can't speak for themselves, both the vulnerable, the profoundly disabled, and the elderly. Our treatment of elderly is as these hostages. Mm-hmm. Has been just completely despicable. We should be talking about bubble isolate subset populations and osmotic immigration, which is the use of either strategic quarantines or testing in order to access controlled populations. And instead, we're just fixated on PPE, right. when we shouldn't be. We should be talking about like what absolutes are, what absolute quarantines are, and how to integrate a new person. You don't just go and drop them in a population. That is a good time. You know, if you have a controlled, isolated population, that is a good time to use an absolute quarantine. And the current CDC recommendation is 8 to 14 days for onset of COVID. Again, the more you give this, the more you take it seriously, the less your risk is.
Right.
And so for shift work or for visitation, that's a good time to use testing for a short period of time where you're not within that space for a long time. And you can say, okay, well, at the start of this shift, you did not have a high enough viral load to indicate that you were transmissibly positive. And so, or you can go hug your grandma. You know, like these things are important. They will give people back liberties that have been taken from them. And I don't care how old you are. I don't care how immunocompromised you are. Your consent still matters in this. Yeah. There are people with stage 4 cancer who can just say, I don't really feel like jumping through those hoops and I'm just going to ride it out. And that's their right. And so is your right to exposure. If you, and it's not saying like, well, you know, go out and do it intentionally, but, but for some people, you know, the ability to just participate in normal life is worth the risk to them. And people take risks all the time that they're either correct or incorrect about. And that's what every other aspect of our lives.
I mean, that's life. You know what I mean? We're not guaranteed anything. I mean, and to that point, I had said recently, you know, if there was some plague that was killing, let's say 1 out of 2 people, and I was looking out my window and I saw people just dropping like flies, if I wanted to go outside and risk it, I can do that. You know what I mean? I don't know that I would, but that's kind of my point here. But I agree with you wholeheartedly. You know, I get a little, you know, this is something, this is a topic, and I realize probably my followers on Twitter, you know, get tired of it. I know my staff sometimes gets tired of it when I talk about this stuff, but to me, this is probably one of the biggest issues of our lifetime. Not just with illness, but with, you know, freedoms and liberties. But I think that you mentioned the people that can't speak for themselves, like the kid thing for me is my biggest issue. And I mentioned before with the school situation. And I think at least with this school that I'm dealing with, what the parents and the staff want to know, and this is something else. Nobody, it's almost like there are no goalposts. So they're not even moving the goalposts. Parents are asking specific questions. When can we take these things off? Where are you getting your data from? Who are you waiting to get permission from before we can do normalcy, right?
That's why surveying everybody is so important, because then you can go up and you can say, we asked every single person in this school and 97% of us want complete normalcy. What can we do about that other 3% so we can have that back? Because this is, we're just done. And, you know, in Florida, we have a round table with our governor, and we had, you know, Jay Bhattacharya, Martin Kulldorff, and Atlas, and then, you know, another round table with Sunetra Gupta. And we have that. And then our local school boards, you know, and they're saying masks aren't safe for kids. And they're saying, you know, children should not be required to wear this. And then you have a director from the Florida Education Commissioner, Richard Corcoran, who says, you know, next year, it needs to be where kids can go without them. And then you have our district, Leon County, that I'm in, our superintendent pushed back and say, well, the CDC doesn't say that. And it's like, well, the CDC has also, you know, never addressed how about the test sites? How about we talk about the test sites? How about we talk about PPE? How about we talk about how you're encouraging ages 2 and up to wear something that has no standards for mitigation, and you have no tests to be able to show that this is effective or safe, because those tests would not pass an ethics panel. If you were to say, I want to put a deoxygenating and hypercapnia inducing apparatus on a child every single day, and that child's also going to go in a bathroom in public places where they're going to have flush plumes putting, you know, fecal matter and other pathogens on your child's mask, and then they're going to keep breathing that all day. You know, for kids in extended school programs, that can be 12 hours a day plus on the bus, and the, you know, they're going to drop it on the floor and sweat in it and breathe in that all day. Tell me that that would have passed a review, because that is the reality of what children are going through in our school systems. And that is definitely something worth fighting for. My son was supposed to start school this year. He was supposed to start a little Montessori pre-K program, and they wanted all children masked and distanced behind, you know, with no playtime, no social time. And it's like, I was just sending my son for socialization anyway. No, thank you. Hard pass. And so it's just so sad to me, like, what this has become, and nobody's actually looking at the reality of, like, you're not actually protecting anybody while putting these just insane measures in place. Like, did you see the school system in Alaska that had the kneeler boards and these sad little bins that kids were supposed to sit on? They didn't even like have desks anymore. They had like kneelers with this bin in front of them. And it's just, okay, nothing your kids learned in the past year is worth the developmental milestones they missed, as well as the profound traumatic issues of what they've been conditioned to and exposed to. You'd have been better off having to remediate the academic side of it a year down the road than to have like pushed the developmental milestones that are missed from the masking, from the distancing, the traumatic behavior of being conditioned to fear touch and proximity of others. I've seen other children on the playground with my son who, you know, they stay 30 feet away. And if any child runs over near them, they recoil. And, you know, I teach my children to, you know, respect others and respect their wishes. And I think that this is one place where separate access, this is one place where segregation actually makes sense. Of the sick from the sick or vulnerable from the general population. And the reason for that is immune bombardment. If you're a truly immunocompromised person and you have, you know, been immunosuppressed as well from extended time without contact with the robust biomes of others, it's just, it's a good thing to tread lightly if you are one of those people. But at the same time, I've had a student who hadn't been around other children in 3 years, and it's so sad to me, like, what kind of life truly vulnerable children end up living. And that's why I want to talk about tiered integration. That's why I want to talk about how to properly assimilate children, even the most vulnerable, so that they can have safe social interactions with others, because it's part of who we are as human beings, you know, like, it's just, what differences have you seen in the human behavior side of this in the past year? Like, have you seen an uptick in depression or, you know, ideations or?
Yes, for sure. I've had a lot of parents tell me with their kids, a lot of behavioral changes, a lot of diagnoses, ADD, ADHD, things like that. Also things that would be considered to be physical, you know, asthma. You know, I don't see kids, a lot of kids. Parents sometimes will ask me, you know, lifestyle things about their kids, but things like that. But as far as adults go, you know, I'll be honest with you, when everything kind of went down, my family, my family's all still in this area. We decided early, within a couple of weeks, we're not going to not see each other. We're not going to pretend, you know, for about 2 weeks, I'll tell you this. I live a little north of Pittsburgh proper. I have a younger sister who lives a little south of Pittsburgh proper. My mom lives right in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. What she did for about 2 weeks, my sister has kids. I have a boy. She would drive to my sister's, because at the beginning, my mom was a little bit freaked out. Yeah. She'd drive down to my sister's, see my sister and her kids peer through her door, wave. Then she'd drive all the way to my place, peer through my front door, wave at me and my boy, my wife. And then, so finally I got on the phone with my mother and my sister. And I said, here's the deal. If you guys, my sister thinks how I think, how we think. Yeah. But I told my mother, I said, listen, if you are afraid, you're allowed to be afraid. I love you. But when you're ready to see us normally, because I'm not going to have you peering through my front door looking at my boy. He's wondering why his nunny ain't coming inside. Yeah. But so we've been normal. I've been normal. I do Brazilian jiu-jitsu. I have dudes sweating and bleeding on me. You know what I mean? I've been normal. But I know it's gross, but I'm as normal as you.
Normal, sweating and bleeding on you.
Right. So, but for other people, and I'll tell you this, when somebody comes to my clinic, new patient, existing patients, and some of what I do is virtual. Mm-hmm. When I have, like I said, I have 9 staff, you know, physicians, RNs, NPs, medical assistants. If people come physically to my clinic, I would say 90% of them walk in with something on their face. Yeah. Okay. Now, we do not require it. We say, you know, they're not required here. If you're comfortable, you can wear them. If not, you can take them off. And I would also say that 90% of them take them off. Yeah. And it seems to me, and I had a conversation, I was chatting with a gal, a patient who has cancer. She's doing really, really well. And she always wears this bedazzled cloth thing. Right. And she asked me, she said, so Nick, you know, what do you think about this? I'm like, the mask? I'm like, what do you mean specifically? You know what I mean? I mean, are you asking me if that's working? Is that what you're asking me? Because I mean, it looks kind of cute. It's bedazzled. I mean, but she said, no, you think this is preventing anything? I said, no. And she took it right off. And she's like, you know, I always felt like that, but she's like, I wear it mostly for other people. It's like this weird thing where people are putting these rags over their faces so nobody else gets mad at them.
Do you know what would be really helpful instead of her wearing that thing that could collect who knows what over the course of the day, where she's, you know, also increasing her CO2 intake of re-inhaled breath and decreasing her oxygen intake, which she needs if she's, you know, fighting cancer. It would be really protective if, you know, she were able to have visits where she's not coming in at the same time as sick visits, and, you know, separating our sick from our injured, from our well visit kind of things, you know, even having separate days of, you know, I know that sometimes there are people who need to be seen on a last minute basis, but, you know, the changes in practice of saying, okay, our most vulnerable, we try to book you the earliest and we try to give you easier access into the space, you know, maybe come through a back door, don't commingle with the general population in the waiting area. Because even when I take my own kids to the doctor, I wait in the car until our appointment time and go straight into our room, because I don't think that, you know, mingling with sick people is a good idea for you to do with your kids. So, you know, and just, you know, the little changes like that would both be respectful and convenient to other people who are actually in need, and have identified themselves as such and also in want of such protection, because that matters. But that's another time that it's important to just, you know, be specific. And at the beginning of this, like, I have some family members who newly consider themselves vulnerable, and they kept asking their doctors, like, should I do this? Should I do this? And I think that so many doctors have said yes because they don't want to be seen as increasing risk and being at risk of malpractice for that. But I think it could kind of go the other way around, that, you know, especially with children, you know, when you prescribe a medication, you don't just say like, let's spin the wheel and,
right,
you know, see which one you land on and we'll just give you that. Like, this is like, you know, if you're prescribing, I don't know, come up with something that's really severe and has really severe effects. What's something you can think of?
You mean that so like super high blood glucose.
Okay. So super high blood glucose, I'm just going to give you like a mild antibiotic and have a good day. Like, so it's just so mismatched. That's what matters about this, is that everything's so unspecific and so mismatched. And you know, it was just random, but
yeah.
I think it's just really important to try to.
Well,
Let me have the conversation where the relevant actual science, like physics and fluid dynamics, comes into the conversation, you know, because that's a big part of it.
Let me ask you this. What do you think, you know, not everybody has your knowledge. So what do you think, you know, maybe for like what would you recommend to parents? Or, you know, I have these meetings at this board and, you know, what's interesting, like I mentioned before, is, you know, you present the data and anything that you possibly can. And I don't know, it seems like if somebody has their mind made up, you know, they're going to do whatever. But if you're giving advice to people, lay people, parents, to, you know, especially with kids at school, what do you think their best course of action is?
It depends on whether or not they have an existing exceptionality. If their children do have an existing exceptionality, I would be requesting an IEP meeting or 504 plan meeting as soon as possible to discuss an immediate exemption. With younger children, I would also be requesting a teacher comfortable with not wearing a mask, especially during those critical language development periods. You know, it's one thing to say, well, I want to protect myself as an employee from these subjects I teach. But that's why it's really important to match educators who are both, you know, certified and willing to teach a given age group or subject area, because your risk is way different. You know, within a given school system, you're not going to tell me that a sixth grader takes care of himself the same way that a four-year-old does. But a school system, you're serving people of all different ages, and you know, four-year-olds are grody, and you know, a 12-year-old probably won't do that to the same extent. And so, just, you know, looking at human development as part of this, and all of the, you know, respiratory risks, and it boggles my mind that people aren't seeking out education attorneys in mass right now and really trying to take this down in school systems, because it doesn't seem like something that's just going to go away on its own. It's kind of like everybody's been wrongfully convicted of being walking pathogen all of a sudden, while having their rights, even if they were walking pathogen, completely disregarded. So
is there anything in over the past year or so that you think that have there been any logical decisions regarding this?
In the U.S.?
Hey. Yeah, let's the U.S., yes.
I think that the logical decisions are to start to include the correct people in the conversation, like the North Dakota House hearing expert testimony from Kristen Megan Kelly and Tammy Clark. You know, that is a logical decision to go and to ban the requirement of this apparatus within your state from hearing from senior industrial hygienists and OSHA experts about how, you know, the specifics of respirators and the specifics of, you know, integration requirements for workplaces, even, you know, starting that conversation of how medical consent and medical clearance is part of this conversation. Because you might have somebody present themselves at knocking at death's door, you know, of, you know, having it being in respiratory distress in your office, and for you to say, hold on, you know, I'm not going to give you oxygen. I'm going to get you this apparatus that makes me feel better about myself that doesn't actually, you know, protect anything. I think that starting to shift the conversation to what is a mask is just as much of a conversation as saying, what is a shoe? There are many different kinds of shoes, and you're not going to show up in stilettos to play soccer.
Right.
And that'll help change the conversation on a national level about how we're educating people on personal protection. Our health department in Leon County gave out 16,000 cloth masks specifically to vulnerable individuals, nursing homes and developmental care facilities. I'm laughing. It's so not funny. It's so not funny that you're truly vulnerable individuals who really need you to be specific got the COVID equivalent of being handed out a bunch of condoms full of holes or lambskin with, you know, protection against sperm, but not HIV. And you're calling it HIV mitigation. Like it's no different than that, what we're seeing. And it just needs to, it really just needs to shift to, this is a particle. It has a specific particle behavior. And what really matters then is minimum effective dose.
Right.
Because, you know, if you're in an outdoor space, if you're in a field and it's windy, your risk of, you know, exposure and your atmospheric viral load is very different than if you're in a 10 by 10 room with 10 people and two of them are transmissible positives and you don't even have a fan running. Like, you know, what is clinging aloft within that space and how is it being filtered out? We should be talking about, you know, HVAC systems and environment sanitation with UVC sanitation instead of handing out hand sanitizer and spraying surfaces. It's, you know, we, our health, I'm just taking digs at different health departments in Florida, basically, because that's what they're all still giving out is like hand sanitizer and non-sterile masks that were made by people in the community. And I understand, like, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions here. I understand people saying, okay, there's a shortage of N95 or higher grade respirators, so everybody's going to do their part and whatever, but we never actually got specific. And we just decided as a collective society that instead of addressing a supply chain issue and a public accommodations issue, which is all we ever really started out with, we had higher than normal number of people who newly considered themselves immunocompromised at the same time that we had an issue with being really specific about PPE. And we started there, but we kept saying, well, there's a supply chain. We can't get that to everybody. So instead of addressing that, we just tried to lower the baseline to something that it can't be lowered to. And in places where, in states where they're trying to get OSHA to rewrite and say, okay, well, we will include cloth masks or something of that nature, they're completely getting OSHA to defeat the point of itself, which is workplace protection. You know, if you have all of these standards and you've been around since 1946, and I'm sorry, that's not OSHA, that's CDC and World Health Organization, but the CDC and World Health Organization have been around since 1946 and 1948. And I think we all expected there to be a better plan in place. I'm in Florida, we have disasters all the time. And, you know, if it flooded and someone showed up with just a handful of leaky boats and some moldy bread, that's about what we got as our national COVID response equivalent.
The leadership in Florida, the people that you talk to, I mean, is it, I mean, from my point of view, what I see about you know, Florida and some of these other states is, you know, besides the fact that they're open and people are calling them open, I mean, does the leadership down there, the people, the powers that be seem to, I mean, are their heads screwed on right?
I'm in Tallahassee, and Tallahassee is not open. So Tallahassee is in the middle of four other districts. It's like the center, and then you have north, south, east, west around it. And to the west of us, that was one of the first Florida districts to go under mask mandate, but they're pretty loose about it. Uh-huh. All of the other three surrounding districts, one in South Georgia and two in Florida, that are within about a 25-mile radius in each direction of Tallahassee, they all have about two grocery stores to our 40. Hmm. They each have a maximum population of about 32,000 to our 400,000. And so us putting a mandate in order has immediately seen an uptick in people increasing concentrations in their districts. Hmm. And, you know, that's kind of the natural reaction. That's what you do. You go to the places where you feel like, okay, well, this is the kind of normal to me that I want to be a part of. And, you know, that's what life is like for us. We drive a lot more than normal because, I just think it's important for, people to be able to support the areas that aren't acting like this.
Right. No, I agree.
I don't want to support, you know, a city that, creates a heightened discriminatory atmosphere for the public sector without ever voicing accommodation for the people such as myself who have medical exemptions to masking, and or the people who just want to support the people who have medical exemptions to masking so they don't have to be treated like a freak every time that they go in public. You know, it's right. It's when you really break it down and hear all of the people who do have the exemptions, that some of them have medical issues, some of them have, you know, profound trauma issues and PTSD from abductions. And it's just, there's so much out there in this world, and trying to throw a blanket over everybody also includes a, you know, a 350-pound profoundly autistic nonverbal individual who also, you know, has a penchant for biting people. Right. You know, there are you have to be able to say you've covered every single base with public accommodations, and when you fall short on that, you know, that it's then you haven't accommodated anything, you haven't fixed everything until you've accommodated the chaos of the full public sector.
Right.
So,
you know, a couple of things here real quick. I was just, as you're talking, I'm thinking about, you know, there's obviously, you know, you're, where you're coming from. And then I, you know, for me, I consider myself to be, you know, a simple guy. For example, my boy wrestles, and a couple of months ago, he had several tournaments this past year. And a couple of months ago, there was this huge tournament at a place at Pittsburgh, East Pittsburgh. So we drive out, there were hundreds of parents, hundreds of kids. They had 10 mats going at once. And for the most part, nobody really in there was, you know, cared all that much about anything as far as, you know, masks or anything like that. But what I found kind of odd was they had a rule that you couldn't shake hands after your match. It's a wrestling match. So you can roll around and wrestle, right? These are 5 and 6 year olds wrestling, but you're not supposed to shake hands after the match. And so, I mean, there are things like that. You look at that and you shake your head and like, yeah, that's crazy. But to me, that's kind of, it's kind of falls in line with the idea of, yeah, I know that this gator I'm wearing, but I do it anyway type of situation. So I think it's almost like a combination of using some common sense, but at the same time, like what you're talking about, you know, there is legit mitigation. And even again, with these schools, and I'm going to all the stuff. And by the way, I appreciate you being so patient and giving with all your data that you send me, because, you know, I'm going into this school with all this stuff. And the woman yesterday was very grateful, and she was like, her eyes were wide open. So anyway,
there's, you know, I keep posted on the new offerings on Rational Ground also. They keep everything really updated with data on there as well. And it's just a really good resource for just so many different areas of where this is having an impact. It's just kind of going across the board there. And I just really encourage people to have an open mind. I'm not saying that every single person out there in public health and epidemiology is, you know, the big bad wolf or anything. It's just, I think that this was something from the beginning where people said, this is a medical problem. The doctors are going to solve it. And you've had the attention of every medical doctor in the entire world for a year. Right. And it's just a little more complicated than that, because a doctor is not going to tell you to take undue risk. At the same time that, you know, everybody's saying, oh, you know, the doctors are saying to wear a mask. Well, your doctor's been telling you to exercise for 10 years too, and you didn't listen to them there. And, you know, it's just risk is something that's not always set in stone. And when we're actually trying to mitigate risk, we need to make sure that we're just being inclusive of all of the voices out there. Because if you're going in a store, if you're going in a big box store, or you're going in a hospital, or you're going in any setting, and you see zero bare faces, then that means zero people within that space are having their ADA, you know, workplace rights met. And right. In a lot of places are saying, well, it's just cheaper to get rid of people than it is to write in meaningful accommodation, and that violates federal law. And right. So we need to, we need to see people pushing back on that.
Yeah.
And just saying, you know, as workers, we have protections. And especially, man, one of the biggest things for me throughout all of this has been seeing masks on pregnant women. I've had three children. My kids are ages 1, 3, and 5. And I'll tell you, like, you know, this is fresh for me. The care that is required of a developing body, and the care that's required in being really specific of the risks you're putting a pregnant woman in. So you're telling me you want me to decrease my oxygen intake, and you want me to expose myself to all of these things while, you know, that stress my system further, while you're telling me I can't eat brie. Like, you know, it's just be a little bit more helpful. Why don't you tell me, hey, if you're going in a public space, maybe you would consider like wearing an airline and supplementing your oxygen intake while you're going in a space like that. If people were actually giving like, you know, recommendations like that to people who are vulnerable in other areas, I'd start taking people seriously. But yes. There are no blanket applications to fixing people.
Right. No, that is true. That is true for sure. You mentioned rationalground.com. While I'm thinking about it, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter at Mamasaurus Meg, MamaSaurus Meg, MEG. I know how to spell my name. Sorry. on Rational Ground, I have a bunch of different articles up on there. I have a full reopening guide and a reopening guide for school districts as well on how to use tiered integration systems and bubble isolate subset populations. And then I talk a bit about some of the atrocities that have happened as well, both with, you know, workplaces and education systems and masking on kids. But like in Florida, there's a woman named Franca Panettone, who was a 46-year-old woman with Down syndrome, who was basically taken from her family, put in bed restraints for 10 days. She was diagnosed with COVID, but all medical consent, all medical advocacy was completely thrown out the window. And these are the practices of our hospitals. She was not, you know, granted any access to any of her family members or her, you know, her designated medical advocate. And her family had to watch her die over an iPad on a ventilator. And, you know, these are the kind of things we can't undo as a society. And people should know her name, and people should be writing bills to prevent things like this from happening to other people and following them. You know, these are the laws that matter. This is what, we claim to be such an advanced species, but I just don't see it with practices like this.
Right. That's crazy. My goodness.
So anyway, at the end of all of my articles, there's contact information on there for me as well.
Awesome.
And I do try to write back. I'm a zero inbox kind of girl.
So. And you are very good at getting back and responding to. So yeah, Megan, listen, this has been fantastic. I greatly appreciate it. Is there anything else that, you know, that you want to let anybody know before we go? Just anything at all?
Fight it.
Yeah.
Fight it. If you feel like you're personally being persecuted during these times, maybe you just need to hear that you're right. Maybe you just need to hear that you're not going to feel better until you feel like you're actually doing something about it. Because I, before all of this, I had no Twitter following. I had no, my media days were over. I've been a comfortable stay-at-home mom for a long time. And I just kept waiting for people to say the right things and didn't ever, expect my relevant background to kind of come up and be needed right. in this capacity. But, it's when you have something to say, it's your responsibility to step up and say it, especially if it can help other people who may have the similar plight as your own. So, right.
Well, listen, Megan, this has been fantastic. I appreciate this. People need to, this, like I told you a million times, this is something, people like you are the ones that need to be, known in the media on these huge, these podcasts, these guys and gals that have these huge platforms. So I thank you greatly. It was wonderful having you.
And I think that the biggest misconception is, it's been this separation into like pro-mask people and anti-mask people. And then there are the people who are like me who are just saying, can we just be like specific for a minute? Can we just talk about what we're actually talking about and get into the details of that to make sure that what you're recommending to people isn't getting people killed? I just consider that really important. Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for like feeling that way. In every single, you talk about these big shows out there, it's not as if they even need my contact information. They've heard from me. I've called every U.S. Senator and House of Representatives member, same for the entire state of Florida. These people have heard from me. Right. and if I can do it while juggling what my responsibilities are, then, you can try a little too. I'm not telling you to spend your whole day working on it, but...
Well, we'll keep fighting for sure, Megan.
For sure.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for
having me. All right. My pleasure. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All right. Have a good one.
You too.